finally today, what's one of the most obvious signs you're about to step foot into Harvard Yard? Well, there are many, but I'm thinking specifically of the brick walls and those iron gates. And imposing walls, such as those, ivy-covered or not, have always been physical metaphors for exclusivity, security, and power. And it is from within those red brick walls that a surprising new analysis of the deep cultural significance of everyday doors, gates, and locks in Western society comes from. It's done by Daniel Yuta. He's a historian of early modern and modern Europe and author of the new book, The Straight Gate, Thresholds and Power in Western History. I spoke with Daniel earlier today, and he told me why he thinks doors are so important.
If you had asked me a few years ago whether I would ever sort of undertake a book-length study of doors and keys and gates and all these technologies of enclosure, I would have been, surprised. But I realized just how important they are subconsciously often for our sense of privacy, our sense of security, notions of property. And that's why I got interested in these objects. I'm not an architectural historian, but I consider myself a cultural historian. And I came to realize how important these objects are for our sense of culture, domestic culture.
Yeah,
it's
interesting because you were saying privacy and security. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking to myself that in my sort of nighttime routine, when just before I'm going to go to bed, the last thing I do every night is check to be sure our front door is locked.
Right.
And in your book, you write that the book itself is a history of the hopes and anxieties that Western culture has attached to these kinds of thresholds. So what do you mean by that?
Well, anxieties, I think that is very much in line with what you just described, that fear of unwanted entry, which is, I think, runs very deep. There's generational change. People from a generation ago will tell you that they were still able to leave their front doors open, to not lock them. That has obviously changed quite a bit. So we worry about these things, even if we're not always conscious about them. My book starts with an episode from the end of World War I, when the population in Germany and in Austria, the two countries which were about to lose the war, protested against the government order to dismantle their doors. The government was trying to take in metals and turn them into weapons. In that process, they were trying to seize door latches, door handles, everything. Even though you'd think that after 4 years of this very draining war, people would have other things to worry about, this is what led to an outcry. And I start my book with this episode of people protesting, because it tells you that even under such duress and in such situations of crisis, people's sense of privacy and their fear about intrusion are enormously strong.
Mm. I mean, but this seems to be peculiarly Western, right? This idea that the door and the lock on the door can afford us some sense of privacy, because the whole world doesn't necessarily think this way. I mean, in Japan, there are sliding doors that are usually made out of wood and paper. They are not necessarily designed to be impenetrable.
Right.
Thresholds.
Right. And that is one of the things that I started to realize more and more as I was doing this research, that this is a very Western way of thinking about safety, security, about domestic culture in the end of the day. It's fascinating to see, as you say, that there have been other societies across the world which have developed very different approaches. I think that traditional Japanese architecture is a fascinating example indeed, because here you have these sliding screens that you mentioned. You had for centuries the technological knowledge to produce keys and locks was there. We know that. They had highly advanced technological skills. They could have produced these things, and yet they didn't, because they had social mechanisms. The multi-generational household, which was the norm in a place like pre-modern Japan, included that kind of security mechanism where often an elderly household member guarding the door. In the Western world, we've come to rely a lot on technology. And I think it's intriguing to think that there might be social mechanisms of security, if you will, that one could use as well.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the iconic doors or gateways right here in our own community. Mm-hmm. I mean, you are at Harvard right now, mm-hmm. and Harvard's got some iconic gates, obviously, all around Harvard Yard. And in fact, was it a couple of years ago, there was some sort of outcry when they decided to keep the gates closed mm-hmm. at night, and so the general public couldn't pass through Harvard Yard whenever they wanted?
Right. Right. It's actually my first year here when the Occupy movement happened.
That was it.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they restricted access to Harvard Yard. And I suppose most American institutions of higher education have gates. And it's a social filter. Of course, the most extreme manifestation of this are the gated communities that have become so prominent in this country, in America. Those are often also communities of privilege. I mean, so are academic institutions, obviously. And it's interesting to see how, again, this metaphor of passage and of archways, of portals comes in, because it's so powerful, I think, in the Western imagination.
Right. So we were talking about sort of the social significance of doors and gates and thresholds. They're also very political as well. I mean, you have a chapter in the book about reading doors, and you talk about Martin Luther from the 16th century and how, of course, he famously posted his 95 theses of protest on the church door. There's a controversy about whether or not he actually physically did that.
It's funny because in 2 years from now, many people will celebrate the 500th anniversary of this event, which is really iconic. In Western history, it is sort of an iconic moment. It had huge repercussions, obviously, also on American culture in the end of the day. This is what sparked the Reformation. And as we all know, the Reformation had a huge impact on American history. And now, the interesting thing is that if you take a closer look, we don't really know if this happened. Luther himself never mentioned that episode. There is no contemporary account describing him posting these theses to the church door of Wittenberg. So I decided I'll use that door as sort of an entryway, if you will, into that story of the early Reformation, and to show how doors were more generally sites of information circulation, how it was very common, in fact, to post things at doors. So I do think that he posted the thesis, but it was totally unrevolutionary. So the way Western Civ textbooks or whatever depict this is an exaggeration, because actually, if you put these things in context and look how important doors, especially church doors, were for people at the time, this was a very common thing to happen.
Well, let's just stay with its political significance for a moment.
Right.
Because, you know, right now, literally, in American politics, once again, the discussion of, you know, building a wall on our southern border with Mexico is front and center in the Republican presidential race. So, I mean, does this get us back to the sense of the illusion of privacy and of security, and here it's sort of played out in the theater of politics?
Right. See, this is one of the lessons I think you can learn from this story of city gates that I'm talking about in the book. For centuries, Europeans invested enormous amounts of money into their city fortifications, city walls, some of which survive, lavish city gates, all of which were meant to, keep certain people off, keep certain people away. And of course, there was also part of the military to defend the city. In the end of the day, it was rarely the case that these things ever functioned the way they should. There were many walled cities that were still conquered. The people who wanted to get in did get in, even if the government didn't want to get in. So I think it's a reminder in this whole current discussion that, you know, no wall, no gate is sort of unsurmountable. There will always be ways in. I think it's really one of the things you can learn from that story. And Europeans ultimately decided to do away with these city walls. In the 19th century, there is that radical transition where all the major European cities defortify their walls. And I think this is a reminder, you know, for in the current political discussion that, you know, a physical separation will only get you to a certain stage, and it doesn't solve the problem.
Really. Yeah. Well, speaking of today and the modern era, this idea of what doors represent has, you know, it's even fully sort of realized in the digital world, right? I mean, we use the language of security keys when it comes to, you know, sort of long strings of digits which are supposed to give us some sense of security over our digital information. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how even in a place where there is no physical infrastructure per se, this concept of doors is so very powerful?
Right. Yeah, I was fascinated to realize that as well, that how in the virtual world, these sites have taken on a whole new meaning, and they remain as important as they are in our physical reality. So we do speak of security keys, indeed. There are gateways, right, on the internet. There are portals.
Exactly.
Portals. It's not surprising to see how these sites are playing such an important role in the virtual world, because they do in our physical world, even if we're not always aware of it. And what I've tried to say, that the enormous importance of these sites for the way we visualize security and also privacy,
Yeah. You know, it suddenly occurred to me that the mythological significance of doors is or thresholds is really everywhere. I was just thinking, you know, certain vampire myths say that, like, the vampire cannot cross the threshold unless he's invited in, right?
Right. In that respect, as you say, this lingers on in popular mythology and maybe in movies. But I think we have developed a slightly more rational relation to doors and gateways more generally, in that we no longer have, I mean, the number of superstitious rituals connected to them has certainly shrunk. I describe in the book that for centuries it was very common for Europeans to bury animals, even live animals, under the threshold. It was called the construction sacrifice. That was one way in which people tried to fend off evil spirits. And this is a period when people still believe in these kind of supernatural evil influences. So you still see that, but nothing on the scale of what you would see in the medieval period or the so-called early modern period, sort of before the rise of modernity.
So are there any lessons here for Western architects then?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, again, I'm not an architectural historian and I'm certainly not trained as an architect. But how to think about boundary-less spaces is a big challenge in contemporary architecture. Obviously, we've also become more aware of the fact that these boundary spaces can be a huge impediment to people who are physically handicapped. So there has been much more awareness in the past 10, 20 years about creating boundary-less spaces, because you realize it keeps certain people away. Certain people can't cross these thresholds, and they're kept out physically from buildings, from communities. So how to make spaces more open, communities more open, that is a task for architects, I think, every day anew. Things like locks and keys won't go away. But to think about how to make space more permeable, more open, will remain a constant challenge and task for architecture.
Now, the title of the book is The Straight Gate. What is that in reference to?
To this very day, I'm not sure that's the title that a reference that would be easily understandable to everyone. It's a line from the New Testament where Jesus says, "I'm the straight gate, and you have to pass through me to get to salvation." And I thought I'll use that line, though some translations now translate it as the narrow gate. But it goes back to that idea that sites of passage, portals especially, have been incredibly powerful for the way we think about salvation. And Western religions have used them in that way to describe the gates of hell, of course, the gates of paradise. If you think about it, how we think about salvation and eternal punishment and the whole drama of theology, you will find a gate in all of this in the end. And it's a reminder how powerful these sites have been.
We can't even escape gates when we escape this mortal coil. They follow us everywhere.
Exactly.
Well, Daniel Yuta is a historian of early modern and modern Europe, and his new book is The Straight Gate: Thresholds and Power in Western History. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Magna.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for being with us, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.